Hey everyone, this is Jamie Bateman. Real quickly, I wanted to share with you something that's been pivotal in the growth and success of my businesses, and that is my partnership with Haven Financial Services. I've been working with Haven for over a year now. Christine Valdez was on episode 70 of this podcast, so go check that out if you want to hear her story. It was a fantastic personal story for sure, but Haven has been awesome. They provide me with monthly reports that are super clear and discernible, and that provides me with clarity and focus so that I can do what I do best, which is running my businesses, not preparing financial reports. Again, if you're in the market for a top-notch financial service company, or if you just want to check one out, go to www.jamiebateman/haven and check out Haven Financial Services. Again, that's jamiebateman/haven. Can't recommend them enough. Christine and her team have been fantastic. So I definitely recommend you check out Haven Financial Services at www.jamiebateman/haven. Let's get back to the show. In today's episode, we get the chance to chat with Michael Puglio. Michael founded two different companies, Eon and Carbon. Both are in the real estate space. And he has a vast amount of experience in both commercial and residential real estate, as well as in finance on Wall Street and consulting in the Wall Street world. Really, really a fascinating story. Michael left his W-2 and his consulting gig, but it was over time, over several years, where he transitioned into becoming a full-time real estate operator. Not only that, he moved from, you know, the East Coast to Boulder, Colorado, which was a pretty bold move, pun intended. And we also chat a lot about Michael's upbringing and the independence that he gathered because of the fact that his mother had epilepsy and his parents got divorced and he went to boarding school. So he really was forced at a young age to become very independent. And those skills that he gathered as a child and teenager really paid off, have paid off since then, and gave him the strength and ability to become an entrepreneur over time. This one is very relatable for anybody who is working a demanding job. Maybe you get paid well, but you're thinking about going into real estate, either part-time, full-time, maybe passive, active. Michael has a ton of experience with regard to all these different asset classes and different approaches to making money in real estate. But we also talk about the ups and downs of being an entrepreneur and how it's not all smooth sailing, and you know that no one ever has arrived, and that things, that the journey can affect family, and you know, it's not all rainbows and butterflies and unicorns. So I think you're going to enjoy this one. Buckle up.
Welcome to From Adversity to Abundance, the go-to podcast for real estate entrepreneurs seeking not just to thrive, but to conquer with resilience and mental sharpness. Each week, join us as we dive into the compelling world of real estate through the lens of mental fitness, where challenges transform into opportunities. Get ready to transform your mindset and expand your understanding of what it takes to succeed in real estate. Let's explore these stories of triumph and resilience together.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Bateman. And today we have with us Michael Puglio. Michael is he's a real estate expert, and he's the founder and CEO of Eon Capital Partners, as well as the founder and CIO of Carbon. And we're going to get into what those two firms do. Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Man, I feel like with your background and your story, we could probably have five or six episodes here. You've got a pretty broad and diverse background, but a lot of expertise as well in different areas. So this is going to be exciting for the listener who's unfamiliar with you. What are you up to today? Who are you? How do you define yourself today? And maybe what's some of the abundance that you're living in right now?
Sure. Yeah. So first and foremost, I'm husband and my wife and I have been married for nearly 10 years now. Met in college. We have three beautiful children, a 1, a 3, and 8-year-old. I live in Boulder, Colorado, with my wife and 3 children. And as you mentioned, I am the founder of two different real estate related companies. One, Carbon, which is a private equity company where we buy primary large apartment complexes throughout the United States. And then Eon, which is a single family real estate services business and education platform where we really help individuals become investors for the first time or really grow and scale their business to achieve the abundance and the freedom that they're looking to achieve
Yeah.
through largely free resources.
Now, this is great because one of the things I'm trying to do on my show here moving forward is really focus on helping the individual investor, real estate investor, narrow down and decide which niche they want to pursue, whether they're an experienced investor or not. And there's so many different ways to attack the real estate investing space and so many different ways to make money. There's not a one size fits all answer. And there's passive investing, active investing, residential, commercial, and all of those have subcategories. And just I think this is you're going to be the perfect guest for this. Let's jump back though. Our show is called From Adversity to Abundance. I know that number one, you're not living in only abundance right now. You still have adversity day in and day out. But before we hit record, you and I were chatting a little bit about some of the adversity that you've unfortunately dealt with in your life and how that may have kind of helped you build your businesses. Can you speak to specifically some of the adversity that you've been through on the personal front?
Sure. Yeah. No. I will. So I think, growing up, I grew up in New Jersey, with a well-to-do, relatively well-to-do family. So we always had food and housing and everything. But my mother has epilepsy. She relatively well, relatively uncontrolled at the time. And so that was really difficult for myself. I have a sister who's 7 years older than I, as well as for my father. And so everyone kind of dealt with that in their own way, whether it be an avoidance strategy or a lot of avoidance strategy. Maybe it's a, so
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of frustration, a lot of anger, and just a lot of tense living, like for many years. And I think that one of the things that came out of that, and there are certainly a lot, and this is not a this is meant not meant to be a therapy session, so I
Yeah.
won't bore you forever
So
on this,
some of
but I
these
think,
turn into almost a therapy session.
right.
That's
Yeah.
okay.
And so I think some of the things that I think came out of that have really helped me in my business and my the abundance side of things is really the grit and the independence of needing to at a very young age do things on my own, whether it's I needed to make my own dinner and at a very young age, or I needed to figure out how to get from one place to another because my father was working and there was no one who could bring me anywhere because my mother couldn't drive. And so just being and nowadays that might be crazy, the idea that a 6, 7, 8-year-old would go on a bike several miles away to somewhere to go do something.
Yeah, right.
But back then it wasn't
Why
that
didn't
big
you
of a deal,
just
I guess.
use Uber Eats?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I wish I we had
No,
this service
kidding.
called Roadrunner actually, but it was like in a magazine that you would order
Gotcha.
from with a phone, like where you dial.
Right, a
But
real
anyway,
landline.
yeah, with a landline. And so there was a lot of independence at a very early age from that that adversity. And then when I was 13, my parents got divorced. My mother at that point had started to become healthier, more controlled in her epilepsy, and which is great. And she lives independently now in New
Nice.
York, and that's fantastic for her. But then at that point, when my parents got divorced, there was really nowhere to go. And I went to boarding school at that point, a prep school. And so that just really further, enhanced kind of the independence, my independent nature, and my ability to figure things out on my own and just be always thinking about how could I get this done, on my own back or with my own brain or my own resources, whatever those might be. So I think
Sure.
that, definitely helped. And I've carried that through into my business career and my life through today
Right.
across personal and business.
Love it. I mean, I don't love that you had to experience all that adversity, but You know, and everyone, it might be easy for someone from the outside who doesn't know your story. You mentioned you guys had resources, right? It sounds like you had some money compared to other families. It might be easy for someone on the outside to say, well, they've got money, so they've got it made, so it's super easy, you know, easy living. But the fact is, you didn't have, sounds like, a super functional, you know, family or the most supportive environment. And that's not throwing any particular family member under the bus or anything, but you had to figure things out on your own. So,
Yeah, we'll keep that for the family therapist, throw you
yeah.
on the bus part.
Right, exactly. But I mean, you know, so okay, so walk us through, I guess maybe we're going to gloss over a good bit here, but from, you said boarding school, what was the rest of your schooling like, and how did you kind of grow into becoming an adult?
Sure, yeah. So I went to this school in northern New Jersey called Blair Academy, which is a a good prep school. And I my father recently sent me all of my transcripts this is like 20 years ago right now. And so now I'm reading over the break, over the Christmas holiday, this all these letters from my counselors. And I'm very shocked that I made it through there,
Oh,
that
really?
experience. You know, I was
Yeah.
not an easy student to deal with. And it, you know, you lived on campus, so your teachers were quasi parent like figures, right? And that's sort of the point. People lived, you know, a lot of the parent or the teachers lived in the dormitories with the kids. And so I got up to a lot of, you know, a variety of different types of trouble. But I made it all the way through, and I realized somewhere early in my kind of junior year that, hey, I gotta get it together, or I'm just not going to go to where I want to go next, right? I want to go to college. At that point, I knew, hey, I want to go into either law or finance, and I wanted to do something that, you know, seemed commercially successful to junior in high school. And so, you know, because I had that desire, that goal, I
So
was like, okay, I
sorry.
gotta pick it up.
So
Yeah, go ahead.
what do you think that, and it's not it's a very, you know, common thing that people want to be successful. I'm
Sure.
not saying it's not, but where do you think that drive came from? I mean, why did you really want to be so successful?
Well, I think, as it related to finance, I think it was relatively in vogue at that point. This was before like technology and becoming a software engineer was like the sexy thing to do. And going into finance was like the thing to do if you were going to want to become successful. So there was a lot of pop culture pressure around that. And then I think on the law side, I was always someone who people would say, oh, wow, you really are good at convincing people of doing things, or, you know, like, oh, you really talk a lot, you should be a lawyer, you know, that sort of thing. And so I got a lot of that feedback from family, friends, et cetera, as a child. So it was one of those two things, that I think kind of
Makes
steered
sense.
me.
And I think also the part of the country that you lived in, it on the
Right outside of
finance
Manhattan.
side, made a
Yes.
lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so talk about your career on Wall Street. How did things progress from
Sure.
that standpoint?
Yeah, so I ended up picking it up in at the tail end of high school, and managed to limp into getting accepted to Boston University, which was good for how well I was doing in school, so I was happy about that. And moved. I wanted to go to a big school. Boarding school was, 400 people total, so I wanted to go to a big school. So got away a little bit from the Tri-State area, New Jersey, where I grew up. Moved to Boston, and in my junior year of college, had a good time in college. Not really spending a lot of time thinking about what I was going to do, other than like specifically, like I know I wanted to do finance, but I didn't really plan that much. Had a lot of fun those first few years. Then I said, hey, I got to pick it up again, and just sort of like just in time type of thing. And I got a internship. It was such that I was able to potentially graduate early in college, because I did start to, in sophomore year, really pick up my pace and my ability to do well in my classes and such. So I had the ability to graduate in 3 years instead of four, but I really didn't want to leave like my cohort and everyone that I was with. So instead, I went part-time junior and senior year, which was also a lot cheaper to go because I was paying by the credit versus by the year. So then I also picked up a job and worked at Merrill Lynch for about 25 hours a week in my junior and senior year. So I picked up sort of like a co-op almost that I created myself. And that's kind of like got me into Wall Street and Merrill Lynch in Boston and on the financial advisory sort of retail side and worked for a financial advisor doing, cash flow analysis and, needs analysis and budgeting and social security estimation for clients as an intern. And so that was kind of my first, wear a suit, take the train, go to the office type of, stuff.
Pretty different from the college side, right?
Yeah, definitely different than, gym, go to the gym, go to a couple hours of classes, take a nap, go party, start over.
Exactly. All right, so you graduate and then what happens?
Yeah, so graduated in 11. There was not a job available in the office that I was working as a financial as a new financial advisor without a book of business. So, and I know why now that made sense, but to me, I was like, I've been working here for several years. Why is there no job here? So, I moved back to home at that time and was able to get a temporary position at JP Morgan. I was doing a summer analyst position at a small like kind of a small financial advisory shop in New York. So I was kind of in the game there, and I got a call from a recruiter to do a temp position in vendor management effectively. Basically the vendors that price the mutual funds for JP Morgan. And I was in that role for about a year. And at that time, I was just networking around the bank, trying to find out how I could get to the front office where the trading desk was, which is really where I wanted to be long term.
And that's because that's where you could make more money, or what was the reason to go to the trading desk?
Yeah, so I think the vendor management was like project management. It was there was nothing.
It's not super
Wasn't
sexy.
super, yeah, it wasn't super interesting. There was definitely a ceiling on the income side. And really my vision of being in the financial services industry was all about being in the action, being on the trading floor, people yelling at each other, right? In the boiler room or whatever. So I networked kind of through coffees. It's sort of like half the whole game there was just about having networking opportunities and having coffee with people. Ultimately built some relationships with people in the bank and got myself onto the analyst into the analyst program on an off-cycle basis. So got put into the 2011 analyst program and for the investment management part of the business. So started to work on the fixed income trading desk at that time as an analyst, doing all the analyst things that you imagine, Excel work, PowerPoint presentations, working really late, coming in really early, all that sort of stuff.
Gotcha. So talk about the grind. You were starting to get to that. So, I mean, and I know we really want to focus on the how you left Wall Street and that
Sure. Yeah,
transition.
I'll go through this one fast. So I did that for a few years. I think what I realized at that point, it was tough at I met my wife, or at that point, girlfriend, fiance, depends on kind of where we were on time frame. When we were in Boston, she was at BU as well. And once she finished her master's degree, she came back down to New Jersey, and I was commuting from Princeton. We were living together, and I was commuting from Princeton, which was about a 2 hour commute each way. So between the 2 hour commute each way and the 10 to 12 hours a day in the
That's
office,
brutal.
it was just really brutal. And just no time for anything else other than work. Then something had to change there. I either had to move to the city, which wasn't at that point something we were willing to do, or I had to find something else. So after I finished the analyst program, I then moved into consulting for a smaller shop in the middle of New Jersey, so I could be closer to where we were living, also closer to my wife's parents, and where we could really start a life together. And that kind of took me out of the Wall Street frame, that kind of stress. Consulting wasn't as much of a departure from that stress as I thought it was going to be. Still relatively reasonably long hours, but not as big of a commute, 20 minutes each way by car. So that was a huge improvement. That's around the time when I was in the consulting world, I had a little more breathing room where I started to realize, hey, this can't be this
This
doesn't
is
feel like success to me. I'm looking at my boss, I'm looking at my boss's boss, and I don't love either of their lives.
Yeah,
I
you're
don't
seeing
like
how
either of their lives.
right. It's not that you don't love it. It's like you don't like it at all, and you're seeing how your life likely would play out, right?
It's like, yes.
Okay, so how long did you do the consulting thing?
I was at that position for about 4 years, but that's where I started to build kind of a side gig in real
Gotcha.
estate.
Yeah. Well, I think a couple things there, and we have different stories, but I also went, you didn't go part-time, but I went part-time at my job, I don't know, 2015. Yeah, 2015. And then I really started to build my real estate investing on the side. And those were, single family residential. We were using the Burr method to build out our rental portfolio. But I think the other point I wanted to make sure I drive home is that you mentioned this, the headspace or that kind of bandwidth to think about a shift, right? So not only were you seeing what you didn't want your life to and your career to progress toward, but you also now had a little bit more headspace and a little bit more time to process those thoughts and be a little more intentional, it sounds like, about where you wanted to go. Whereas if you'd stayed in the grind with the commute, probably would have just burnt out or just, but you wouldn't have had that headspace to kind of, be intentional about where to go. So 4 years consulting, and then what happens?
So during that time in 2016, that's when I started buying, just like what your story, it seems, started buying single family distressed properties in Philadelphia using the Burr method. Rates were
Nice.
low, leverage was
Yeah.
high, credit was available. So I did, in that, I would bought every month I was doing another deal, recycling
Nice.
capital. So did about a deal a month for that first year or two.
And you were holding those properties when you could, or?
I was holding those properties, yes, because I was mostly able to recycle capital out of those deals and cycle them every
Nice.
90 days. So I
Yeah.
had enough cash
That's awesome.
to kind of do that. Now
A little
I
harder
did a
now in today's market
little bit harder
conditions.
now, you need a little bit more money, and
Yeah.
then the numbers don't work out at
Right.
just as well. And but even so, I think what I realized after doing a lot of deals was, that $100 a door, doesn't get you that far when you have to pay your bookkeeper and you got to pay your project manager. And if you really
Right.
have a business, if you have business expenses,
Right.
you need to have a lot of houses to man to
Volume.
do that, or
Yeah.
you have to sell houses as you go to generate liquidity.
For
So
sure.
I after doing 18 of these projects, I was like, this is, $1,500 a month is paying my bookkeeper. I'm not making any money in cash flow. If the
Right.
goal here is to get to freedom,
Right.
break away from the job, have enough money to not
Yeah.
work the job,
It's not
I'm gonna need
working.
like 300 houses to get
Yeah.
there.
No, I think that's something that's really somewhat overstated in the real estate investing spaces. And I'm still in the residential space and we're mostly focused on mortgage notes, but really the appreciation is, and it's impossible to really time that, right, perfectly. But long term, real estate's very forgiving and you can make money mostly via appreciation. I'm talking residential. Cash flow can help. For sure, but it's not going to change your world overnight if you have a handful of rental properties. In your case, you're saying, 18 or 20, but even still, yeah, the expenses climb after that. So, okay, so now when did you actually stop doing the consulting then?
So I wanted to get to the point where I could, hit my income from consulting before I kind of left that
Right.
vine and moved on to the next one. So I was able to do about that, 20 units or so in the portfolio, continually recycling cash, and then using the cash I recycled to buy a 36 unit apartment complex with kind of like all the money I had left, right? Like, again, with a hard money loan. In the south side of Chicago. So like totally different market. At this point, I had moved to Boulder, Colorado. So I realized that, hey, I want to go into real estate full time. There's no way I can do it while also working 70 hours in consulting. And certainly I can't pick up the phone until I have the conversations I need to have in the office. So I had
Right.
asked my boss, hey, I want to work remote. And this was pre-COVID. And this was, they still have the kind of the Wall Street mentality. So like, no, you
Right.
can't work remotely, even though I work completely independently on a computer, no reason to be in an office.
Right.
So at the end of 2000, I don't know if it was 17 or 18, I'm missing the year now. I was like, listen, I'm moving to Colorado. So either I can work remotely there or you can replace me. And it
Gotcha.
was such that, consultants are billed out at like, five times what they pay. So it's like valuable for them to keep us. And so they said, hey, yes, you can work
Nice.
remotely. You just didn't try hard enough last time you
Right, right,
asked.
right.
So that's when my wife and I moved out to Boulder, which is where we live now.
Yeah.
And I maintained for about another 12 months the job as a consultant until I could really get
Gotcha.
that income, really
Nice.
get that 36 unit through the Burr
Yeah.
method. And
So,
then that did produce enough income that I was
nice.
able to make enough money to leave that job and parlay it to more real estate.
Now, two quick questions. I don't know if we covered this, but why real estate? And why'd you really want to jump into real estate?
Yeah, so I think what I realized about there's two I think two things. One, with a lot of other like professional services or high where you make a lot of money per hour, you do a lot of work and you make a lot of money, but then there's nothing there at the end, right? You don't have anything, nothing pays you forever, right? I like the idea of, hey, I'm going to do a corpus of work. I'm going to work for 3 months. I'm going to put a lot of time and effort into this, and I'm going to get paid forever after that. Maybe not as much as I would from being a lawyer. Like I was like, even now when I look at this and I'm like, the lawyer's making as much money on this deal as I'm making up front, but then I'm going to make five times as much over time. And that was the really
That makes
appeal was the
sense.
delayed gratification of the long-term benefits of real estate. So that was one. Two,
Owning an asset, right? I mean, that's really what it
owning an
is.
asset, right? Yes. And two was that my family's been in real estate in some capacity for a long time. So my father was a developer. He was building single family homes. Uh-oh.
Yeah, you froze
Get
there.
back to me. Okay, there we go. We're back. So my father was in real estate and was a developer and did a lot of speculation, which is one of the reasons I ended up going to rentals because I didn't really like that roller coaster of a ride. But so I was around real estate since I could walk. So it was a very familiar asset. I spent a lot of summers digging holes and leveling ground and going to, pick up toilets to bring to the job site. So I was familiar with the asset class
Makes sense.
and was comfortable with it in that
Yeah,
sense.
no, and again, different variation, but when I kind of started sh saying, all right, how do I, why do, what do I want to do here? This job isn't it. I started realizing, thinking like, who do I know? Who's in my network? What are my strengths? What, not focused so much on the obstacles, but my father was a residential real estate agent for decades, still is. My brother was a loan officer, and I had worked at a title company and a mortgage broker for a little bit. So you just start to realize, yeah, same reason. It's like, I'm comfortable with this thing. So I get it, and also wanting to own assets. So the second question was why Boulder?
It's not super scientific there. I guess two reasons. One would be Google the top 10 places in the United States to live, and Boulder was on there. And I cross-referenced that with a place that didn't have an office for my employer. Because if there was an office, I would have had to
Smart.
gone into the office and I'd be back to where I started. So the first choice was San Diego, but they had an office there, so that was off the
Interesting.
table. And so Boulder was number two. And the only difference, I guess, where the only big gaping difference from my perspective was that there's no ocean. So that's
Gotcha.
the big killer. But yeah,
What you
the
meant to
Boulder
say
for
was
sure.
your wife demanded you move there and you didn't have a choice, No, I'm just kidding.
No.
I'm
And
joking.
it was the other way around. And I pulled her to Boulder.
This is maybe what you told your employer. No, I'm just joking with you, but so it sounds like you did a little bit of a a little bit of a slow. You didn't just rip the Band-Aid off immediately. It was over years, really, of building out your real estate investing portfolio and that kind of thing.
I
So
think
then,
about three years, two or 3 years of kind of like when I started to the point where I got to, because I was also making good money. So I think if I had started earlier or I had less expenses, I had a, one child at that point, so I had a house, a mortgage, wife, child, making good money. And so, it was, I wanted to not replace my expenses, replace the income. So it was, it took a little while to do that.
That's a pretty high bar. I mean, just briefly, we've had Kevin Dahlstrom on the show twice, and he also uprooted his family and moved to Boulder as well. And He was making really good money at the time, working a lot of hours as a CMO for, I think, Mr. Cooper, the CMO. But, it's hard to turn to just leave something where you're next week you're getting paid, I don't know, 100 grand or something or whatever, or more, and it's like it's hard to just stop that. So, but sounds like you were able to build up to that income level or at least close to it with your, was it just rentals you were doing on the, on that side?
Was rentals, first singles, then the
Right,
multifamily.
right, right.
And then I did do some foreclosure flipping
Gotcha.
as well
Okay.
to generate some more cash. And then
Okay.
I parlayed all of that into start doing some JV deals, started raising money from other people, kind of to be able to do bigger deals,
Yeah,
more
yeah.
scale.
Well, and that's a key piece we talk about as well. It's like no matter what niche of real estate investing you're in, eventually you run out of your own capital, and or at least the capital that you have set aside to devote to this, right? And so you've got to be able to figure out how to access other people's capital and provide them some type of benefit return for the use of their capital. We also glossed over the fact that you have your CFA and CAIA, which I know are both kind of a big deal. And my brother got the CFA, and that's no joke.
Yeah,
When did you get those?
the CFA I did largely while I did the first couple levels while I was working at JP Morgan. I think I wrapped that up at in consulting, and then I did the CAIA also when I was in consulting.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
So.
I just it's I mean, and there's so many different designations out there, and some people are not familiar with those particular ones, and those are not easy. So you have a lot of people in real estate who don't have the financial background that you have. So I imagine that's been a big benefit for you, and also your networking skills that you mentioned earlier. And then the big thing was the independence that you talked about from childhood that was kind of forced on you. It came out of the conditions that were forced on you. So talk about the transition, leaving your W-2, or if you're 1099, doesn't really matter, but really going all in 100% on real estate. What was your mindset like at that time?
As I had said, it was very much I was looking at, the ghost of Christmas future or whatever, right? Like what that the my boss looked like. He was 10 years older than me. He was making maybe twice as much money, but he was working longer hours and than I was. And it just didn't feel like that was going to be the life that I wanted to live
Right.
and how I wanted to show up for my family and for my
Right.
community. And I frankly, I thought I could make more money too, actually going out on my own and having unlimited income potential, because consulting at the end of the day is billed by the hour. And so there's
Right.
only just so many hours you can bill, and there's just so high of a rate you can charge
Sure.
for the services that you're providing. So ultimately, decided that once that income was there and I could make that change, that hey, it's time to make the move. And it wasn't all on me. I spent a lot of time listening to various books on mindset, and joining different groups. One, for instance, was GoBundance, which I
Yeah.
definitely credit as a group that of folks that helped hold me accountable to what was possible, and ultimately take the leap and know
Yeah.
that, hey, I have the skills, I have the ability. I may not know exactly how I'm going to get there, but like I
Right.
know that wherever I am, I will be able to get there because I
Right.
have that, inside of me.
Well, the truth is, you could likely go back and get a consulting job at this
Yes.
point, right?
Yeah.
So,
There's a there's it's a two-way door, I guess, is like what Jeff
yeah.
Bezos say. Like, is there
Right,
two-way?
right. And how from the family perspective, was your wife supportive, or how did those conversations go?
Yeah, so interestingly, a few like the real estate market's been a little bumpy these last, I don't know, year
Yeah.
or two since
Yeah.
the Fed pivot. I don't think she really realized the decision that was being made at the time necessarily. It's like, oh well, okay, if we stay on this path and we just moved to New York, and I just walked to the office, by this point I'd be making, multiple seven figures in a W-2 job, working from 7 to 4 on the trading desk, pretty good life. From my perspective, and I
Right.
think from hers as well. And it was like, I wouldn't say it was guaranteed, but it was put the hours in, I was well liked. I was performing well. I would have gotten there in, 3 to 7 years from when I left. And versus, starting from scratch and then having to do it anyway in my own way. And ultimately we got to a great spot, but if you looked at like the probability of those things, there probably would have been a higher probability, safer to just
To
stay
stay.
where I was. And I'm not encouraging people to do that. I think I'm really happy with obviously what I've done. My family, where I live, everything. I get to I'm gonna go pick up my son at the end of the day. And from school, I work school hours mostly at this point. So that's really I'm really grateful for all of that. But from my wife's perspective and your question, I think she's like, huh, I guess I didn't really think about that at the time.
Well,
But
it's more
she's
of a
always been
roller
really
coaster.
supportive, super supportive. Yeah.
It's like, entrepreneurship is tends to be more of a roller coaster, from an income standpoint and hours work standpoint. It's not quite as, as definable, if you will, and predictable in that sense. So speak to the person who, may want two different things. We'll start with the first one, who may want to leave their W-2. And every situation is different. We get that, but maybe a younger, I don't know, someone who's 30 years old, and is considering they're pretty far along in their career, established, but they hate the grind. They don't like the way their boss looks as far as his or her health or relationship with family members, and they're like, this real estate thing looks appealing. How do they decide, whether they should leave their W-2 and whether they should just do a side hustle or, what factors should they consider?
So I think it's always a great idea to test the waters, and you have the ability to do that in today's environment. There's so many tools out there that even when I started weren't available to be able to do analysis from your desk. Whether and there's just so much more resources available for free to learn about it, to execute on transactions in your local market, across the country, whatever you want to do and whatever strategy you end up picking. So I think it always makes sense to try something out, because real estate, it's not some magical unicorn business. It's still a business. Just like if you were going to go out and say, start a small business, and I want to have a series of laundromats, or I want to have a franchise of this or that, right? Like, it's still, you're going to be operating a business. There's going to be work involved. There's sales, there's marketing, there's operations, there's finance, there's HR. It's all the same types of things in different formats. And so you have to make sure that that's for you. And if that's for you, you get to test it out. That's great. And then from there, you can kind of go a little bit more in, go a little bit more in. And from testing, you can figure out also what strategy is most appealing to your personality.
Well, that was my second question. That really was kind of determining which niche or which strategy to pursue in real estate, whether residential, commercial, passive, active. There's so many different niches, and obviously we're not here to cover every one of those in detail. But anything else to add as far as just determining which niche someone might pursue?
So we don't in the financial planning world, which is where kind of like I started my career, we have this thing called the IPS. I think it was called, now it's been so long, but investment policy statement, right? Investment policy statement. And you would basically like determine your risk tolerance, your willingness to take risk, and your ability to take risk. And that would sort of like frame out what things you could invest in, right? If you were someone who had a really high income, and you had great savings rate, and you were really young, you had a really high ability to take risk, right? But your personality type might be really conservative, so your willingness to take risk might be really low, and so your willingness will trump your ability, because it's more about your mindset. And so if your mindset was such that you're really conservative and whatnot, then even if you're 25 and you're really conservative, and you have a lot of money, you're going to benefit from taking a small amount of your available cash and doing something small. And so even if you make a lot of money and you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars in your 401k, and you're like, I can just, take, that $300,000 or $400,000 and do $1 million deal because I can afford it. It's not about what you can afford necessarily. It's about what your mindset can afford and what you
I like that.
know. So I would recommend doing the smallest deal possible that you could muster, because all of the deals are still based on a physical asset. So whether or not you're doing short-term rentals or long-term rentals, or you're fixing and flipping, or you're flipping a contract, or you're doing some sort of creative strategies, or you're doing Airbnb arbitrage, like all of these different things still revolve around a physical asset, and there's some business that has to happen. And there's some project management, there's some, tenant relations and things like that. So just try to minimize your financial risk. Do the smallest deal that you can possibly imagine. That might be, $10,000 to $50,000 in cash. You may have some debt that's associated with that, and but it really is going to depend on what market you're in and whatnot. And
No,
if
that's
you're in
really good.
California, you're probably not going to get to find a deal of that size. So maybe do a deal not in California, and be willing to do a remote deal. But stay small, and position sizing, I guess, is another a way of thinking about that. Like really think about your net worth and try not to risk more than, 3 to 10% of that net worth in your first transaction, because that first deal is all about learning. And you're gonna, even if you lost all the money from that first deal, the lessons you'll learn is kind of like your education. Now, we don't want you to lose all your money, but if you are going to, better lose 3 to 10% than 50 to 100%.
Absolutely. That's really good. I've never had it, someone on the show talk about that lesson, how to apply the what you did with the IPS from Wall Street to real estate, because there are several factors, and one of which is your personality and your appetite for risk. Because let's face it, sleep is really important as well, right? Sleep in relationships. All right, we got to pick up the pace here. I know you're doing another show after this. We're going to hop off in a little bit. I do have some rapid fire questions, but before I get to those, talk a little bit more about Eon and Carbon and kind of what roles you play with those two companies.
So starting with Carbon, my partner Cody and I started that in 2020 time frame, and really with the expectation of building a multi-generational vehicle to acquire real estate on behalf of ourselves as well as clients. So in that business, we raise capital from investors, from the individual accredited investor all the way up to institutions. And we typically buy deals between $10 and $50 million. Most of these deals are between 100 and 250 units, built in the 70s to the 90s, primarily in the Smile States or the Sun Belt States, basically places with high population growth, good schools, low crime, places where families want to live, but workforce housing primarily. So they're mostly renters by necessity versus renters by choice.
And you're the CIO of that company
Yes. And
currently?
so, I mean, Cody and I make joint decisions, but I would definitely call him. He's more of the operator, and I'm more so on the deal side. I find the deals, get them under contract, get them closed, and then he's responsible for all the hard work of actually getting those assets to perform in alignment with what we thought we were going to be able to do. And he does a fantastic job, along with our entire, we have a property management company within that. So all of our assets are vertically integrated, and we have construction, property management,
Nice.
and asset management inside of
So if you
that.
don't deliver on the pro forma, then it's Cody's fault. Got it. No, just joking. Just joking.
Well, he sits on the investment committee. He has to sign off on all the deals. So if he doesn't feel like he can perform, the deal doesn't get through committee.
got
So
it. All right. And then Eon, what's Eon all about?
Eon is a more of a real estate services and education business. That's where we really help individuals who are just getting started or looking to move from maybe single family to commercial, get the knowledge, the information, and the confidence to do their first or their next deal. So if you're looking to make your first $10,000 in real estate through flipping contracts, or you're looking to move from fix and flip to your first commercial deal, we're basically here to provide you the support through education or through services to do that. And we do that nationwide for clients
Is
everywhere.
it a community? Is it coaching? Is it mentorship or all the above courses?
So what we found is that we've done a lot of deals. My team and I, we've done over $1 billion of transactions over the last decade or so. And so, we find that the two biggest things that hold people back is the mindset or just the overwhelm of information that you need to know maybe to get over that first hurdle of starting. And so there's two things that we offer. One, if you just want to get the information, we have a free school group where people can go in there and get all the information, no gating of information there on how to get started, how to do wholesale transactions, fix and flip, rentals, even commercial deals. We provide that all in there, as well as we have daily calls in there, Mindset Mondays. We do sales tactics. We do deal reviews. Anything you can imagine, we bring experts in to execute on all of that, as well as I am in there every single day to help review deals. And we also have a deal desk where people can actually bring deals, submit them, get feedback, and then work with us on a JV or some other capacity, depending on what they're looking for.
Got it.
So we do all of that. And then the second thing we do is, instead of providing coaching, which is sort of like a middle ground, we just, for clients who don't want to do it themselves, we'll just do it for you.
Okay.
So you just
done
pay a
for
fee
you model.
And we will just do it for you. You watch, meet with us every single week. We'll let you know what we did. We'll provide the reporting, the analytics, and basically make sure that you are set up for success over a 12-week period. So we essentially will guarantee that you will get your first deal done in the first 90 days or you don't pay.
Oh, nice. Awesome. Sounds like you're delivering a lot of value to a lot of different avatars there, which is really cool. Almost out of time. Are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Oh, I don't, you didn't give me any of these in advance. So I feel okay. Yes, I guess so. I guess I'm ready.
What's one thing that people misunderstand about you, Michael?
It's a long list. Okay. So, I think I could come off a little bit direct and abrasive sometimes, when really I'm just trying to get to the truth faster.
Yeah.
And so, I'm a truth seeker, and sometimes I can come off as abrasive or argumentative. And I think that's something that people.
What's one of your biggest failures, and what did you learn from that?
My biggest failures, and what did I learn from that? So you talked about the CFA. You know, I ended up failing the level 2 exam the first time I took it. It is something that I probably studied for 500, 700 hours and, you know, put in every night for 6 months after a 12-hour day. And it was and, you know, time away from my, you know, fiance at the time, like, just, you know, it's a trade-off. And
that
so
sucks.
That was really brutal. But I, you know, picked myself back up and took the test again and passed it the second
time. You can
take
it again in 6 months or something. Is that
it
right?
I think it was a year.
Okay.
I ended up having to wait. But
gotcha.
Yes, I got it done ultimately.
If you could go back and give your 18-year-old self some advice, what would that be?
My 18-year-old self, a little bit of advice. I think it's hard to say, because I really love how everything turned out. So I don't, it's like the butterfly effect. You don't want to change anything, because it could change everything. But if you know, just as a
well, let's assume
exercise,
you wouldn't listen to yourself. What would you try to?
Oh, right. Yeah. So maybe, yeah, I probably wouldn't have listened to myself. So that's probably true. I should have thought a little bit more and been a little more thoughtful about, what I was going to do with my future, and try not to think, I was a little bit short-sighted and like just in time with a lot of things I was doing.
Sure.
And again, everything worked out the way I, you know, ultimately, but
again, 18, who was
when
like
you're
that,
18,
right?
I think that's natural, but I think more than most people,
gotcha.
I think
push the envelope on deadlines
push the
and
envelope
things.
On just in time delivery.
Got it. If you could go back, I'm sorry, if you were given $10 million tomorrow, just somebody cut your check for 10 million, what would you do with it?
I would put it into the, into SBX, and I would take the dividends, and I would invest that into real estate or invest in my
Nice.
businesses.
Awesome. How about one book, one or two books you could recommend for my listener?
One or two books. I think, a relatively newer one is The New World Order. I think that's a great one. And then, that's really about market cycles and market timing, things like that. And then I really am into podcasts, more than I, not read a lot of books, but certainly podcasts. I really love Founders. It's a podcast about founders, and I would highly
That's a good one.
recommend,
For sure.
People, and you can get like hundreds of book recommendations from listening to that
podcast.
So
Yeah.
Highly
That guy's,
recommend that.
He's really good. What's one question that you wish I'd asked that I have not asked you?
I don't know. I feel like you did a great job. I don't really have any other
Awesome.
questions. Yeah.
And speaking of podcasts, you do have your own podcast. What's that called?
It's called the Deal Flow, or Deal Flow. And
Nice.
it's a podcast focused on chatting with institutional investors, capital allocators, and other folks in the middle market real estate space. And we just talk about deals. We talk about strategy, how people find deals, how they do the deals, how they raise the money, just all
Nice.
the inside conversations that maybe people don't get access to. We try to bring those out to become more accessible for folks.
Fantastic. Well, Michael Puglio, where can our listeners find you online?
So you can go to michaelpuglio.com, my website. On there, you can find, that you can book calls there. You can also link from there to our school community, which is absolutely free, or you can go directly to school and just search for the DealMaker Fast Track, and that is the community's name. So either way, there is a great place. I'm also on LinkedIn, I think. I mean, I am on these places. I don't
Yeah.
check them as much. So the
All
first two is probably the best place. Although I do have a bunch of social profiles that people can check out as well.
right, one last thing before we hop off. What's the biggest psychological barrier you see newer investors facing today?
I think it's the belief that you need to have all the information before you make a first step. You're not going to have all the information before you make the first step by design. It's sort of a circle. So you need to make steps forward in order to get more information. So it's kind of like a game of poker. You have to keep participating in the game to get more information. So just expect that you're going to have to participate and throw a little bit more into the middle of the table, chips wise, whether that's time or dollars or what have you. Just keep throwing the chips in, and you're going to,
Love
eventually win
that.
the
That's
jackpot, I guess,
awesome.
if I was
That's
to.
really good. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Michael. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jamie. I appreciate you guys having us on, and enjoy and enjoy the rest of your day.
And to the listener, thank you for spending your most valuable resource with us, and that is your time. Specifically, your time and attention together. So we thank you for that. Also, please share the episode with a friend who can benefit from this and check out our website, adversity2abundance.com. That's the number two. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversity2abundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
Hey there, it's Jamie Bateman. Ever felt boxed in by life's challenges? Dive into my new book, From Adversity to Abundance, Inspiring Stories of Mental, Physical, and Financial Transformation, available now on Amazon. From a former bank robber's redemption to a young entrepreneur's victory over hurdles, these stories are not just inspiration. They're the roadmaps to your transformation. Whether for you or as a powerful gift to friends and family, especially those who might not tune into podcasts, this book is a beacon to a life of abundance. Ignite that inner fire and set your course to the life you've imagined. Purchase yours today on Amazon and light the path for someone you love.